Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Rob McKeefery, and this is episode number 232. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Really appreciate those of you that like, share, comment. Just helps me continue to highlight the great people in our business doing fantastic things. I want to specifically thank Gym Aware for sponsoring this episode. As you know, I'm a big Gym Aware fan, obviously tracking velocity and any kind of analytics within the weight room and being able to provide immediate feedback, I think, is the most important thing to your athletes. And obviously, that's what they're all about. So if you're in that market, I would highly encourage you to reach out to the guys at Gym Aware and just a first-class organization, first-class people. This week, I'm joined by Jim Davis. There's a laundry list of things that you got, Jim. You know, he's a staff and student wellness coordinator at New Trier. New Trier High School in Illinois. He's also the founder of the Illinois High School Powerlifting Association and the director of the Good Athlete Project. And, like I said, in his spare time, he's the most interesting man in strength and conditioning. So appreciate you coming on the show, man.
I appreciate you having me for sure. Thanks.
Jim, I think, you know, there's lots of different things there. And I know that, you know, you've been in the business for a while. You bounced around a couple places, but what in your experience, I mean, you've got a Harvard education, you've got what process, what step along the way really kind of best defines you as you?
That's an intense question. I like it a lot. Best defines me as me. I think, honestly, I think the answer to that might have been in the question. And that's like, I am nuts about the process. And I don't want to I don't want to be cliche with that, but there are nights, honestly, that I worry about myself. I'm like, you know, where is this thing going to go? I like that little bit of uncertainty, but my approach has always been kind of a what's next approach. Like, you know, the New Zealand All Blacks had a saying, better every day.
Right.
And that's the idea. I think I do have a lot of irons in the fire. I work a lot. I don't essentially not work, you know, right. When I'm home after my scheduled hours, I'm still doing things. On the weekends, I'm still doing things. It doesn't feel like work to me, but I'm still working on them. I think the thing with me is trying to find a nice balance of, you know, not biting off more than I can chew, but staying constantly hungry.
Right.
That's the goal.
I think, I can relate to that in so many ways. I mean, it's – A lot of my hobbies are the things that other people would call work, you know, and continually trying to better myself and find new ways and creative outlets. How do you, you know, I agree with that 100%, but I think that there's also people that do that don't, they're always looking for the grass is greener mentality. You know, they're always looking for the next big thing. And I think that can get distracting. How do you stay grounded in the moment and in your current roles?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what you're identifying is really obvious to me early on. I pushed like this hard right out of college. I went to play football for a little while. And as soon as I got back from that, I was working. I kind of ground myself up a little bit in the very early going. So developing a healthy relationship to this progress is absolutely key. And I heard a saying a while back that rings true to me to this day, and always be happy, never be satisfied. And it's kind of it's a constant reevaluation. It's a process of prioritizing self-awareness and some kind of, you know, I want to avoid cliches as much as possible, but some sort of mindfulness practice, whether it's a traditional sense or one that you find for yourself. That's the key, right? I take a lot of notes, and every once in a while I'll just write down, you know, here are the 8 things I've got to do today. These are the boxes they check, and here are the, you know, maybe the 3 or 4 things I've got to do for myself.
Right.
personal wellness on a physical and mental level. At some point, if you don't take care of that, your own mental and physical wellness, I mean, the building that you are building or the pyramid that you're building, the peak comes down if you don't take care of the base level, which is you.
No doubt. I couldn't agree with you more. Well, you don't do all those things without having made some mistakes along the way. What's one of the biggest mistakes that you've made and kind of how you learned from it?
Yeah, like today or?
Yeah, no, that's how I usually answer that question.
Yeah. I think one thing, if you really are like a doer, if you do want to do a lot, I think you become comfortable with making mistakes pretty quickly.
Sure.
And then developing, I think the most thrown around term in the literature right now is growth mindset. And it's like a mistake is like, whatever, I tried that, it didn't work. But, and then going back to that mindful or self-aware idea is like, what about it didn't work? So mistakes, let's see, my biggest mistake, you know, I don't want to double down on responses that have been on your podcast before. I have heard this, but I'm a listener, but I think it's true. Whenever someone says like, you know, whenever you're trying to even momentarily prove yourself to someone else or prove that you know what you're talking about and forget about the 30, 40 kids that are sitting right in front of you.
Right.
That's the biggest mistake. I like to think that I don't fall into that trap too frequently. But you get in front of certain audiences, you go to a clinic or something like that.
Right. Sure.
So I want to make sure I'm being good to people first. You know, this business is all about results and relationships. And, I think the results are sexy. The numbers are appealing and attractive, but it's the relationships that cannot be forgotten about. So maybe in my worst moments, I'd prioritize a championship or certain numbers, or we average this much increase per team, instead of thinking about, you know, what did we do for those kids? How are we bringing them along as people and competitors?
Right. I think that, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I asked the question. I think, you know, there's so much in learning from other people's mistakes and trying as best you can to navigate those landmines as you're going through your own career. And that was always my thought process, is if I can learn from some of the best and then turn around and kind of miss some of the mishaps that they've had, I should be able to get there faster if I'm being smart, you know? And that has kind of been, yeah, that's why I love that question. That's why I love, you know, listening to different people. And, you know, I think we're all guilty of, you know, prioritizing championships sometimes, or, you know, the outcome versus the process, you know? And I think that I can agree with that. Yeah. I mean, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it's impossible to be in this space if you're not competitive, and competitive
people
themselves. And I think somehow, going back to that process idea, your first question, to get competitive about the process, to do that rep better than anyone around you is doing it.
I mean, right.
That becomes the shift of focus away from championships, and then competitive about the process would be key.
Yeah, no, I like that. Well, one of your roles, one of the many, is that you're the staff and student wellness coordinator at the high school there.
Mm-hmm.
Why, I mean, you played football at a high level, you have education, obviously the support, big time, whatever the big time may be, whether or not that's college, pro, whatever.
Yeah.
Why did you choose high school and kind of mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about your role?
Yeah. So, why did I choose high school? This is okay. Ready for this?
Yeah, sure.
My degree, you mentioned, I have a degree from Harvard. It's in human development and psychology. And if I really believe in all the things I say I believe in, literally like human development, as the most important component of education, then I think this is the level where you see greatest amount of effect. We are lucky, our reach is expansive. The high school that I work for is 4,000 plus in a given year. We're now moving about 1,200 plus through our strength and conditioning program. We reach a lot more through the IHSPLA, through the Good Athlete Project. I want to make an impact. You know, there's a difference between being right and successful. And successful, like, you have to help define that. And for me,
right.
is helping as many people as possible. Like you said, avoid the mistakes that I may have made through my career. make sure that this space being strength and conditioning, sports in general, is being used to its top level. I mean, that sounds like success to me.
No doubt.
The paycheck thing is, I don't know, man. Because I do think about that, right? There's an appeal of saying, like, I to be a Division I strength and conditioning coach has been on my radar in the past. There are parts of that appeal to me in a big way. And at least for the moment, I'm not sure I could leave this kind of opportunity where you're with the kid for 4 years at their most, you know, the absolute core of their development, and your voice is the most resonant in their lives, or you're their core model. You know, say you're a football player, you're in football for 3 months a year, or out of the year, 9 months you're with us.
Right.
3 months over 4 years at the most important developmental time in a kid's life. That's where I want to be. Yeah.
What that role, I mean, it's not uncommon for there to be, you know, strength and conditioning coaches at the high school level. It's getting more and more common. It's not, mm-hmm. still, we got a long way to go in that world, but yeah. But I mean, your job is more than that. It's the staff and the student, and you know, and it's not, you know, the title isn't head strength and conditioning coach. It's the wellness coordinator for the, you know, the entire school. What is unique about your job? And what, you know, maybe what's something that another coach could take to present maybe to a school district or a school that would say that this is value?
Absolutely. I'm really glad you asked that, actually, because we're in the process. Alex Nadalna, Coach Nadalna, is over here with me as well. We do a lot of work to try to essentially get our process on paper and create resources for other people. Like I said, leaving what we're doing, and we're trying to scale it. We think it's too good an opportunity to miss. So, when we started this, what's unique about it is that we made it up. That's probably the unique part. Like I said, I was playing football when I was I'd be overseas. I was playing in Europe for a little while. I'd come back, work with our weight room, just volunteer, just having a good time, coach the varsity football season, get on a plane and go somewhere.
Right.
And slowly developed into a position. And initially it was a head strength and conditioning coach, coordinator. We took the program from 80 people in a room and me sitting at a desk that I pulled in from the hallway to what it is now, which is we've got 8 part-time staff members and 1,200 people we're working with. So at every sort of level, we've had to advance. We've had to go through the red tape just a little bit. The institutional stuff is important. And I think one of the things you mentioned, and it is the thing, is how do you essentially like convince people that you're providing real value? I think it's stories are very convincing and numbers are very convincing. So, you know, we're an opt-in program. We are optional. So we've got 1,200 kids showing up, but we're not taking attendance. They don't have to be here. They come because they know that we care about them. They like our staff and because we're making them better.
Right.
You show up, like I said, because of results and relationships. Now we track numbers. That's one of the convincing parts. We have 1,200 people. And if those kids are consistent, they improve, period. You know, we don't have exceptions to that.
All right.
And then the other part is like, you know, how does this benefit the overall learning environment? And the fact is now we're being reached out to from all ends of the school, whether it's, you know, we're working with the social department a little bit. We've got some kids who will not sit still in class, won't pay attention to save their lives, but they'll show up to the weight room every day and they'll listen and they'll work right along the rest of the kids when they're with us. That's the learning they want. And those are the stories that supplement the numbers that make this thing legit.
Yeah. Well, I think we can all agree that, you know, having a very comprehensive strength and conditioning program at the high school level is going to benefit more than just the performance. It's also going to enhance many, many things. Well, I know an area of concern or area of emphasis for you is conducting some research in exercise-induced neural enhancement, you know, right. And how you're being able to bridge the gap to identify what that learning style is for the athlete and being able to translate that to other areas. Talk a little bit about what you've done from a research perspective and what, you know, what's some of your findings.
Absolutely. So it comes from all that stuff comes from, I was inspired by a book by John Rady, Spark.
Yeah.
A lot of really good research into very digestible. So I think anyone should read that book. if they're in this field. But essentially, he looked at mostly like rat models, where you're injecting things with dye and putting them in certain situations and then dissecting them. Things that can't be replicated on the human population, obviously. But he found that, first of all, there's two really interesting findings from his work. The first was, and it's not John's work, he sort of compiles the work. The first one was, there's a study where there's rats in two different cages. There's group A, there's group B. Group A is in a cage with a treadmill. Group B doesn't have any exercise equipment. The first thing that was interesting about the study is that every rat in group A used the treadmill. You know, kind of going back to like sedentary is not a thing in mammals. Like we've learned to be sedentary. We are built to move.
Right. That's probably
the first thing you notice. The other one, the other part of it is that, you know, once when they were in this test for a certain amount of time, they were better at tests of memory. And that's pretty much all you can do with rats. You can't ask them about their mood and their level of focus.
Right.
Memory tests. And then when they cut them open, they found they were able to track. I think there's four or five really important things in the brain. There was dopamine, serotonin, which are probably neurochemicals that people are familiar with. Also norepinephrine and acetylcholine. These are appearing at levels that should lend themselves to increased mood, focus, and wakefulness or alertness.
Right.
There's I won't go too much farther down that. There's this BDNF curve that we could go down, but I'll pause that for a minute and say that it was really interesting to me. And I was like, well, okay, fine, because it, you know, so let's assume that if we put people in a similar situation where they're working out at a certain intensity for a certain duration, a certain amount of time, you know, say 70% heart rate for 20 minutes. And we don't tip over that, because then you go into like more of like a recovery.
Right.
Your body's trying to preserve itself. But if we stay at, say it's 70 for 20, can we replicate that in human models? And most importantly, okay, say we do have an uptick in dopamine, but are people reporting that they are in a better mood? Are they saying, well, let's just ask them, they're humans. Like, are they finding these, is their general state of alertness and wakefulness, has that been improving? Excuse me. So the first test we ran was when I was out east, actually out in Boston. The numbers were like embarrassingly good. It was like 20% jumps for people in their mood, focus, and from pre to post.
Wow.
And the really surprising stuff was the control group, where we had people just sit down for the 20 minutes, like same exact test, except instead of the exercise intervention, you're sitting. And it was like equivalent drops. So like a 20% decrease in mood, 20% actually wakefulness was one of the worst ones. So your body starts to shut down. We had like 30% drops in wakefulness in that same duration. So that was like, you know, compiling research is one, that was study two. And then what I'm working on right now as part of this wellness coordinator initiative is we are surveying, we've got hundreds of surveys, a lot of data input. We're doing it all by hand this time, which we probably have to fix for the next round. But we're essentially saying, can we do that in like a PE class? Because, you know, it works, but all the people that were volunteering for the first one knew that they were volunteering for something had to do with exercise.
Right.
So, you know, they wouldn't be averse to it. When you enter a PE class, especially, you know, freshmen in the middle of the day, they might not want to sweat. They're not
right.
So you can't pick your population. Can we replicate the results in those situations?
Sure.
And we actually, those tests are running for another week, but so far it looks pretty good. The jumps aren't nearly as high. We're not going like 20%, but we're seeing somewhere in the neighborhood of like 6 to 12% increases in those areas.
Wow.
So it's like, I mean, it's pretty cool. It's encouraging. And it all goes back to my idea where it's like I said, that first example, there wasn't a rat that didn't want to move when given the options.
Right.
We like, we designed a school day where we're supposed to be kind of at our peak, you know, optimum learning environment that is built around this sedentary model. So this
right.
thing that goes completely counter to human biology, like that's where we're putting our kid.
Right.
And then we want them to become distracted and disruptive and things like that.
It makes complete sense. Makes complete sense. Well, and I think something that I've always argued from an athletic perspective is you know, you throw him a college athlete in, and then you throw him in a film room for, you know, an hour before practice, and then you wonder why they're sluggish at the start of practice versus the walkthrough mentality of walking through the plays and whatnot. And so I think there's so much to be pulled from research like that. I think what's important is, I mean, you're doing this on top of running a powerlifting association, being a director of a philanthropic initiative. I mean, but you're just, you saw a need, and you're like, I got a question and I want an answer, and you're trying to contribute to the body of work. And I think that's the important part for strength coaches to take away is look around you, ask questions, and then find see if there's an answer. And if there's not, then we have to start to be able to leave a legacy of some sort for our profession if we really want to take our profession to the next level. And I appreciate you doing that.
I appreciate that.
The Good Athlete Project. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, where'd that come from? What's the, you know, what's the genesis and what's the mission?
Yeah. So the genesis was actually, it happened in a Harvard library in January, like 2 years ago. So we're a fairly young organization, and I essentially did kind of what I was saying earlier. I was trying to be self-aware. So I just came up with a checklist of things that interest me, and essentially made a rubric. Here are the things that I'm involved in. Here's what they bring to my life, whether it's some sort of the ability to be creative, personal satisfaction. I don't want to be on the street. So some sort of financial gain, and, you know,
right,
things, all these boxes. And then this idea just kind of came to me. And what it came from really was, you know, I went into this program with a pretty solid understanding. No, I shouldn't say that. With a completely inadequate understanding of neuroscience, but I had a solid interest in it. So I went out there to find out what it was that I didn't know. And in these classes, Todd Rose was my first professor in this. He's actually really interesting. He's got a book out there that should be looked at as well. But essentially found that, like, all these things that the brain is highly receptive to, novelty, the movement thing is obviously one of them, all the things that put the brain in a really powerful learning place. I was like, these happen in sports. So I had come from, you know, I'd left Nutria temporarily, took a leave of absence, went out to Boston to study, and then kept, like, it just struck me. I was like, the thing I was doing is the thing to be doing.
We just want to
make sure it's done right. Right? Because the other truth is, like, you know, yes, it's full of novelty. It's full of powerful mentors and motivators. It's full of emotion in a way that, like, no other subject is, right? Nobody, even the people who are incredibly passionate about history, don't go into a history final the same way they go into a state championship.
Right.
Or even just a, you know, any given game.
Right.
It's full of this. Now we need to make sure that it's done well. And the other thing, you know, I'm, we've been all around the world at this point, and the fact is, it's not always done well. And there's this idea out there that sports teach life lessons, and I kind of counter that. I'm like, well, I've never seen someone shooting baskets alone in their driveway become a better person necessarily, unless that's a component of something else. But the sports don't teach life lessons. Sports serve as a platform for well-intended teachers and coaches to teach life lessons from. Like, it's only if it's done well. It's also the real, I mean, you know this, there's, like, there's the chance to take all that good momentum and that powerful learning and point it in the wrong direction.
Right.
The sporting world is rampant with hypermasculinity and fake toughness and stuff like that. So that's kind of, that was the need that kicked it off. And then, you know, it's a project. So a project by nature is big. The short version of what we do is we are an education consulting foundation using athletics to help people realize their potential. That looks different in every site. You know, we are on the south side of Chicago working group. Just got back from Boston the other week. They look different in both places. 2 months ago, we were down in Haiti. It looks different there. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's got site by site, conversation by conversation build, generally speaking. And we've got some other initiatives too that are pretty cool, but it's big and it's a lot.
So, I mean, Is there a way for people to get involved in that? Is there a way, what's, you know, kind of what's the mission movement? You go in and you consult with the group in Boston. Are you just coming into a PE type setting or a school setting and saying you should be doing this?
No. In fact, we do the opposite. We say, what do you guys want to do?
Right.
You know, it's like, what do you want to do? And if you say, you know, developing the whole child, the whole student, if that's one of your aims and helping that kid reach their potential as a person and as an athlete and all this stuff, then what we do is we share people's behavior aligns with their goals. You can't say we want student athletes, you know, and then not somehow promote academics throughout the course of the year when the schedule gets tough and stuff like that.
Right.
Make sure people's behavior aligns with their goals. We have 4 interacting with a group. We run workshops. We just run 1 or 2 day workshops. We run professional development sessions. And that's really where I think some of the really good stuff holds, because the idea is you plant a seed and then the professionals, the coaches and teachers, they're the ones that are continue to water and make sure that things are in their place. Do a lot of presentations these days. The presentations hopefully lead to one of the first two.
Right.
And then the last way, the fourth way is the in-depth consultation. That's the most time consuming. And we're pretty selective at this point about who we can partner up with just based on.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's awesome. Again, I mean, another example where you're seeing a need and taking your expertise and inserting it in any way you can. And I think that, I mean, it's not just entrepreneurial in nature and smart from a business and just, you know, personal branding and all those types of things, but it's making the impact that we all strive to try to make, you know, and I think that that's the most important thing. And 99.9% of all that, it comes from a place of genuine desire to make a difference.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, you're totally right. And the idea is, I think most people, I don't think we've met someone who doesn't have good intentions, but it's when you combine intentions with great methods.
Right.
The effect that you're hoping for.
Well, one of the other things I think was really unique and cool is the Illinois High School Powerlifting Association, and mm-hmm. you know, and how you essentially, I mean, I think you, if I remember correctly, I think you started a powerlifting team, and then obviously that's led to this. I think there's a lot of coaches out there, you know, high school coaches that listen to the show. There's a lot of coaches, you know, that the sport of powerlifting is something that could be inserted wherever they're at. What were some of the first steps, and talk a little bit about the association?
Yeah, so the first steps in the build came from me reflecting on my own experience. And you know, I after college, while I was trying to play football, I was lucky to win a couple state championships in powerlifting. I felt great about it. I worked my butt off to do it. I really, you know, I felt a great sense of satisfaction. But then I looked around and I'm like, well, I'm in a YMCA basement, and my dad came to take pictures, but it's just me, you know, it's just me against the weights. And there's something to that. There are nights I want it to be me in the weights, and that's okay. But I'm like, you know, the things that I love about football and team sports, they were missing, you know, and we talk about development again. I'm not sure there's a better, more clear line to all the SEL research, all the character development research, than the one that exists in powerlifting. And that's like, you want to talk about growth mindset or grit or lay of gratification or resilience. It's like, show up, you do it right, you take care of your body at night, and whether you're sore or not, you better be here tomorrow, and we're back at it again. And if you can, you know, really use the powerlifting for the teaching platform that it could be, I mean, it's the place.
Right.
The question is, how do we attract more people to it? Because it always goes, you mentioned need, right? You know, no disrespect to anyone, but there are times when, you know, powerlifting, kind of fulfills the stereotype of powerlifting, and we want to, you know, and if that's the case, and you know what I mean by that, you know, anyone who's, it doesn't have to be a meat-headed thing, you know,
right.
Especially if you want co-ed participation, you probably got to rethink the way it looks and the way it feels, the way a meat feels, all that kind of stuff. So that was the first thing. We're like, listen, we think powerlifting, not only is it a good teaching tool, but it's a great entry for some of our female athletes to just keep competitive. make sure that we're serving our female population as well. So let's break down the barriers between female entry and the sport. And then let's supplement it with the thing that was missing from my experience early on, the team element.
Right.
So, everything we do is co-ed, everything we do is team-based, and everything we do doubles as a fundraiser. We won't have an event that won't also raise funds. And the idea behind that was like, we just, again, it's just like this light bulb moment. We're like, the first year we were like, hey, let's go try to win a national championship in powerlifting. We realized, we're like, okay, I mean, what a bold thing to say. Like, you are privileged physically. And then that cannot, for us at least, that has to trigger the idea that there's someone at the other end of that spectrum. So like every time you are out there trying to be at your best, let's also try to help someone else. There, a lot of work for Special Olympics, or we raise a lot of funds for Special Olympics. Embrace is a mental health foundation that we raise funds for all the time. We spend time down at the Infant Welfare Society of Chicago. We're kind of make sure this thing hits on multiple levels.
So let's go into a little bit of the economics of that. I mean, you know, if every event is a fundraising event, I mean, is that, you know, is it the whole lift-a-thon mentality where it's a dollar a pound type of thing? Or is it, you know, you're doing that six times a year? Or is it, you know, you try to get creative in some of the ways that you present that fundraising element to people that would be participating?
Yeah, totally. So what makes this work is that we've got really good people volunteering their time. So the meat fees go to that. These go to our causes. We have an equity model too, where it's like, if you can't afford the meat fee, you don't have to pay the meat fee. You know, if there's a team in certain areas that we're recruiting from, if they want to show up and they don't think they can pay their way in, that's not a barrier to entry. Finance will not be a barrier to entry. So we bank on volunteer work. The meat fees, which we also keep below, you know, as low as humanly possible, they all go right into the fund. We've got some merchandise, you know, the margins on the merchandise all go immediately into the fund. We'd love to have more sponsorship. We've got to actually, you know what? Hand Armor Chalk was, Hand Armor sponsored our last year's state championship. They were fantastic. We really appreciate all their support. And we'd like to have more of that. But that's it. And then you mentioned the lift-a-thon thing. Our state championship is the lift-a-thon. So we've got a bunch of kids descending on a school in the north suburbs of Chicago. And it's a penny a pound or whatever it might be.
Right.
We try to pull in
that. That's really cool. Well, man, if people didn't take something out of this episode, then they were definitely not listening. But we end the show with some resources. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
The best piece of coaching advice I ever received. That's a really good question. I apologize for the dead air time here.
No, that's all right.
I think it's chase the work you're willing to do. I think that's it. And I think, you know, that's been the truth for me. Like, if I see a need, and you've mentioned it, you've highlighted it, and I appreciate that, but like if you see a need, like you may as well just go try to fix it. If something jumps out to you as a problem or an opportunity, fix that problem, take advantage of that opportunity, and wherever your passion lies, go down that road. Now there's an asterisk to that, because like I also have a passion for eating food. I can't make money doing that, and I don't know that it serves me. But as often as possible, chase the work that you're willing to do.
I like that. Give us a book, app, and website recommendation.
Book, app, website. Book, I got to say Spark. It's so lame, but I keep coming back to it. Spark changed my life. I am a practitioner and a researcher in that world, and it changed my life. The other one is Self-Reliance by Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson. There's a great sort of abridged version of his essays. Talks about self-reliance. Another book that definitely changed my life. Book, let's see, app. I'm going to have to open my phone for that.
You said you had Handy or something. That was something I'd not seen. What is that?
Oh, yeah. Okay, listen. I'm a little embarrassed by that, but I love Train Heroic. That's a big one. I use Airbnb when I travel, but Handy is the one. I'm embarrassed to say it, but if something's got to go, it's usually cleaning my apartment. So Handy's like the Uber of services. It's really inexpensive, and it's convenient, and time is a precious resource.
I agree 100% with that, actually.
It's the truth.
Any websites that you regularly check out?
I can't not plug goodathleteproject.com
or
IPLA.com. Websites. I almost want to go to my browser history. You know what? TED. I like the TED Talks for sure. That's an easy one for me.
Yeah, no, that's good. Well, man, like I said early on, I think, you know, what I respect the most about, you know, innovators are people that are innovators and action takers. Yeah. And, you know, I think, I mean, obviously you found your, I think that's something that a lot of people, just young people in general, that what they don't do is they don't take a real kind of inventory of their life, of what's important to them, what they're passionate about. And it's often the advice that I give young strength coaches is, you know, where do you want to be? What are you willing to sacrifice to make that happen? And then go create opportunities, you know, and what you've done is you've created, you know, lanes, these three lanes of things that you're passionate about, that you enjoy, yeah, that you've been able to build a, you know, something that's been able to put food on the table, yeah, you know, but build the lifestyle that you want to live. And I think that so many times we're chasing all these, you know, the big time, these big jobs, whatever you want to say. And then you get there and you realize, like, man, that's not really who I am. That's not really what I want to be.
Right.
And I think when you do things like this, I'm not saying this is you, but when I think when you do things like this, when you build things that you're passionate about, you know, the right opportunities come to you, or you realize that you can create the opportunities that you want. And I think that's, to me, that's really, really impressive. And so I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your journey, man.
Ron, I really, really appreciate it. And I appreciate all the good work that you're putting into the world. And I mean that very sincerely.
Thanks a lot, man.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey. On Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.